case 95-3561-D in the matter of disciplinary proceedings against Jill S. Gilbert. And Mr. Hildebrand, you represent Ms. Gilbert. So you may speak.
May it please the court, I'm here representing the respondent, Jill S. Gilbert. As this court, I'm sure, is now aware, this was a very difficult and a complex case, unusually so in the disciplinary field. And on behalf of my client, I would like to tell the court that we are very grateful for the opportunity to orally argue this case. I'd like to talk about the allegations regarding and the findings regarding fraudulent billings first. As this court, I'm sure, knows, there is a distinction between a case involving alleged excessive fee, which violates 1.5, and fraudulent billings, which is an 8.4C problem. And I think that in this case, the board has tried to show that the fees were not only excessive but fraudulently billed. But the evidence in this case and the findings of the referee do not at all support any holding that there was fraudulent billings in this case. What the board's approach was to do was to try to prove fraud by asking respondent whether or not she performed the work that was on the fee statements, Exhibit 14. And respondent said that she did perform that work and did incur the time. And then the board had argued that respondent is not credible, ergo, there's fraud. You can't prove a fraud case by taking the affirmation of an attorney that he or she performed the work and then saying that that attorney is not credible, ergo fraud. There has to be some proof that the time was not spent.
Well, what can you, what proof?
Well,
she says she did ABC and it took her 10 hours and no one was following her around. We don't know whether it was done. Why can't you say she's not credible?
Well, that's not proof of fraud.
What is proof of?
Well, I can give you an example.
Well, tell me how you prove fraud.
Okay. On and cravat cases prove fraud because time records were checked and more than 24 hours a day was spent. Strasburg involved fraudulent billing of costs. It was a simple matter to look at what he paid for costs and what he billed for costs. In the first Gunther case, the attorney billed for a conference that opposing counsel said did not occur and billed 2.3 hours for a closing that the opposing counsel said only took 3/4 of an hour. That's how you prove fraud.
Now, in this case, she says she did it. You don't have someone else who said she didn't. Is that the point?
That's the point.
And so, because you just don't believe that she did it, because you don't think it would have taken that long, or there's no record to show that any results were made, that's not good enough.
That's not good enough.
What's your authority?
And there's no...
What's your authority that it's not good enough?
There is no authority other than to say that no attorney has ever been disciplined under those circumstances for fraudulent billings.
I know, but...
I've looked at all of the cases of this court, and I have not seen a single case where an attorney was found guilty, so to speak, of fraudulent billing on this kind of a proof.
But there are other cases that relate to fraud that have nothing to do with an attorney which you show fraud. And can you find no case in other areas that would show that because you don't believe them, that's fraud?
That's right. There has to be some other proof. In the civil side, fraud has to be proven by clear and convincing evidence. Somebody has to get up and say that there was fraud and adduce some facts. There has to be more than relying on what the fact finder thinks is incredible denials of the person who allegedly did the fraud. And that brings up another problem in this case. Under the law of the state in disciplinary cases, there has to be findings of fraud supported by the evidence. If you read the referee's opinion, she concluded that she made findings of fraud in only two respects. First, she said that there were excessive hours billed based on an oral, on a written statement where, which is page 115 in the appendix. She read this number, which we've highlighted in the appendix, as a 1 when it's a 6. The board didn't even assert this theory. The second thing is the referee found that some of the fee statements were approved when Mr. Geller was hospitalized, something that both he and respondent said did not occur, even though it was dated. Now, this, again, is not finding a fraud, because even if Geller signed the fee statements while he was in the hospital, that doesn't show that the time wasn't spent. So this whole case, as far as the fraud is concerned, went to the issue of whether or not Jill Gilbert did certain work when she was on vacation in Las Vegas. That's how the board tried to prove fraud. But we brought in her father and her husband, who testified convincingly before the referee that when she was in Las Vegas, she was constantly interrupted doing things for Mr. Geller and could not enjoy her vacation, couldn't even take care of her little kids.
Counsel, does this case essentially boil down to a sufficiency of evidence, then?
No. Well, yes, I guess the evidence is insufficient, but it also boils down to the fact that there aren't any findings. There aren't findings that would justify the conclusion that there was fraud.
What's our standard of review with regard to findings?
Sufficiency of the evidence is up to this court. That's a question of law. Findings have to be supported by the evidence, but the referee only made 2 findings on the fraud count. She concluded this that the 6 was a 1 on her own, basically. Nobody ever argued that before. And then she concluded, or she found, that some of these statements were approved in the hospital. And that's it. So we aren't talking about findings of fact that have basis in the record. What really happened here is, as the board admits in one point in its brief, it says essentially this is a case involving excessive fees. What the board did was pile up a bunch of counts in a complaint and tried to put frosting on the cake, so to speak. But I wanted to spend some time with you this morning to dispel and to talk about the total failure of proof and the absence of finding to justify fraudulent billings. And the reason that's important is it goes to the quantum of discipline. If it's an excessive fee case and does not involve fraudulent billing, the discipline is obviously less than if there's fraudulent billing. So that's the point of all of this. Now I would like to talk about the issue of attorney's fees. The referee made a number of really substantial legal errors. First, the referee held that Gilbert violated Rule 1.581. Now, that conclusion is wrong, because in order to find that, or in order to conclude that the fee was excessive, the rule directs that all of the factors be considered. And case law has interpreted that to say all relevant factors should be considered. Here we have numerous factors that were not considered in the referee's conclusion that 1.581 was violated. The incessant demands of the client for time, preclusion from other work, the substantial amounts involved, the good results. His objective was to stay out of the nursing home. It was almost impossible to keep him out of the nursing home, but Attorney Gilbert achieved that. She devised a plan which we don't know whether or not it would have worked, because it was abruptly terminated, but if that plan had worked, he would have received about $600 or $6,000 per month in COP funds, which would have kept him in his home as long as he lived. The board has tried to characterize this case as a simple assistance case, but it wasn't. Geller had substantial assets, and unlike many older people, he had no family or friends that could or would take up the burdens that families usually take up themselves when a person gets old. So the results here were outstanding and could have been outstanding had Geller qualified for Cobb. The referee also said that the services were not within the scope of the fee agreement. Back in the early days, there was a fee agreement that talked about what Ms. Gilbert would do for Mr. Geller. And as time went on, she did a lot of other things that were not within the scope of that fee agreement. But this holding is that is really scary for anybody who practices law. If you enter into an initial fee agreement and say, I will do this, that, and the other thing for $125 an hour, and then the client comes to you and wants more services, and you continue to bill that client at $125 an hour, what's wrong with that? I would venture to say that virtually every attorney in the state has done or does this. You don't have to enter into a new fee agreement if the scope of your employment expands with the consent of the client. And
Mr.
remember
Pellegrini,
that...
Can I interrupt for a minute? It's my understanding that part of the referee's findings here related to the fact that your client was charging at that $125 an hour rate when like services could have been provided by a home care worker or by a social worker at a much reduced rate.
That's correct.
That's part of the complaint.
And frankly, those facts are true. Jill Gilbert wound up being Geller's case manager, so to speak. And there were agencies in Milwaukee that would charge from $75 to $95 an hour for those services. But it's important to understand how that result occurred. Jill Gilbert hired and Geller fired three different case managers, We Four, Care Finders, and Patty Care. This man couldn't get along with his case managers. And Jill Gilbert wrote Geller a letter, and I've got it in the appendix. I believe it's at pages 113 and 114 in May, which was less, I believe, about halfway through the representation, expressing her concern that her legal bills were piling up and that he should get other care at lower cost. But he refused to do that. And the testimony of the caregivers about how he would pull stunts on them and throw tantrums and even on one occasion intentionally wet his pants to get Jill over there to settle him down and do things down. So what do we have? We have an attorney who is charging a lower than normal hourly rate in the first place, engaging in case management services. And elder law attorneys do this. Just like...
Counsel, when you say...
Just like an estate planner might provide some financial services. And attorneys and a labor attorney will do things that a layperson can do. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Sure. When you say lower than normal hourly services, my understanding of the record was that she used $165 to use as a blended rate to come up with $125, and yet, according to the referee, there was never a charge to any other client of $165 an hour. So what was
the
normal?
Well, my client does most things. She'll charge X dollars for a will, Y dollars for other specific tasks. She does not ordinarily charge people on an hourly basis. But what the record does show, and this is without dispute, is that experienced elder law attorneys in Milwaukee were charging at the time between $150 and $200 an hour.
Does the record show that she ever charged on an hourly rate $165 an hour?
Well, it doesn't show that precisely, but what it does show is that most of her practice is and remains piecework. I think that attorneys have found, particularly when they do the kind of work that Ms. Gilbert does, is that a client is much happier if you say, all right, I'm going to do a will and it's going to cost you $300. And if you've got the forms and everything, you can probably do it in an hour, plus an hour for the will conference. So
you're not seriously maintaining that she would have said, for 6 months I'll charge $112,000 and this is what he would have wanted.
No, we're not saying that. But what happened was is that he made continual and unreasonable and abusive demands upon her time. There were all these late-night phone calls, interrupted vacations, interrupted weekends. This woman did not have a life of her own when she was doing with it, when she was handling this man. Now, of course, we can all say in hindsight that she should not have allowed this situation to continue, or she should have said, no, I will not take late-night phone calls. No, I will not serve as your case manager. And it really is a very unfortunate situation. This project ruined her life during the time it was going on. That's what makes it a difficult and a somewhat sympathetic case.
Well, it doesn't have to be difficult or sympathetic if she didn't commit fraud. What about the $3,000 cashier's check on buying herself a large screen TV?
Well, what about it? She gave a credit. The board admitted she gave a credit. There was no dispute that she gave a credit. She gave a credit the minute it was done. And the minute that Geller transferred lawyer to Ruth Irving's, Jill Gilbert sent him a statement showing that there was a credit for an unused money order. What the board was trying to do here was to invent some kind of a charge of obfuscation, so to speak, which is unknown in our rules. And this came. You should know how this grievance was handled. Part of the time, my client was visibly pregnant. She had to submit to about six depositions during the course of the investigation of the grievance before these charges were ever made. It's very easy to pick things out and say, well, you didn't tell us this and you didn't tell us that. But the board investigator admitted that at the end of the investigation, they knew that she had bought this television set with the $3,000 credit. And they also admitted at the hearing that they knew that a credit had been issued. I don't understand why this was even charged.
What did the referee find?
Well, the referee held that there was obfuscation. I think that was a legal error, as we pointed out in our brief. Lawyers are required to cooperate. And she did cooperate. She submitted to six depositions, and they found out the truth. That brings up, I'd just like to add another, what I think is a charge. This charge about the videotape. The charge is that she submitted the videotape to the board as evidence of Geller's competence. Well, what if she didn't? And the board used that videotape, and it's bad evidence for Jill Gilbert. It doesn't look good. I'll be the first to admit it. But when an attorney gives evidence over to investigators, that's what they're supposed to do. And yet the referee said that it was wrong for her to give the videotape and represent that it showed Geller's competence. There's absolutely nothing in this record to say that she did anything other than give the videotape to the board during the course of the investigation. That's what makes this whole, one of the things that makes this whole disciplinary proceeding so unfair.
Well, he had previously signed agreements with her, hadn't he? And then you have a videotape, too?
He had signed a fee agreement. The practice was that he would sign off on the statements, on the monthly or bi-monthly statements. It was Attorney Schneidman that suggested it be videotaped, but really at the time that the taping occurred, Geller had signed the agreement. Now, that wasn't readily apparent at the time we looked at the tape, but during the trial, my opponent slowed it down, and you could see that he was just writing over his signature.
So what was the point of the tape?
Well, the point of the tape was to follow Schneidman's advice and show the circumstances under which he signed.
How did Schneidman get into this? And this is
Schneidman.
Dan Schneidman.
Yeah, Dan Schneidman.
Milwaukee's
the one person in Wisconsin that maybe knows more about ethics than Attorney Basting and me. But anyway.
As counsel modestly stated.
Yes.
We're two giants in front of us.
She called Attorney Schneidman to get ethics advice on entering into this agreement whereby Geller would turn over the assets and she would run them then and take care of him during that two-year waiting period for Kahn. Now, I would just like to briefly discuss restitution.
And did Schneidman testify?
Yes, he did.
And what did he say about this videotape?
Well, he told her, I believe his testimony was that he advised her to do the taping, and that was it. He didn't do anything about the videotape.
Did he know that it had already been previously signed?
Actually, nobody knew that until we played the tape.
Okay.
It wasn't readily apparent.
But your client must have known that.
I don't know. The tape was made under unfortunate circumstances where the kids were there and Geller wanted the taping done instead of waiting until the next day and she couldn't get a babysitter and that's how that tape came up. Anyway, I think we have shown in our brief that the discipline of 3-year suspension is substantially excessive based on case law involving attorney's fees. And we cited those cases in our brief. Restitution in a case like this is also unprecedented. There was no definite basis upon which restitution could be calculated. And I believe that Your Honor, in one of these cases, wrote a concurring opinion that outlined the problems of restitution and that we don't have any rules as to how to calculate it and what to do. And then finally, the imposition of interest on restitution, again, is most cases do not apply interest, and in this case we have clearly a situation where whatever damages there were are unliquidated. We have so many problems with this record. When we get back to the attorney's fees issue, when you look at the fact that the board came and tried to prove excessive attorney's fees through an expert that expressed no opinion on the case management services, no opinion on the financial services, no opinion on paralegal services, and then to top it off, critical and important documents were not even reviewed. So we come to this court asking for fundamental fairness in the imposition of discipline on an attorney. It is a very difficult situation that my client was in, and I don't think that she deserves to have to pay restitution of $84,000 and wind up with a 3-year suspension because, in essence, during this period, she stood between Geller and the nursing home. She stood between life and death for Mr. Geller, and it's very easy in hindsight. And I asked Barbara Becker this, the expert, what would you do if you get a call in the middle of the night and you try to call the doctor and the doctor says you'd better get over there or your client might expire? This is the kind of situation we were dealing with. And for an expert to say, oh, you should have gotten the case manager or you should have done this or you should have done that, that is not fair and that is not the way you prove that an attorney should wind up with serious discipline such as that recommended by the referee.
Counsel, are you still objecting to the costs of the board's request? As I understand it, an objection exists with regard to 8 of the 12 counts, I think, bought by the board were allegedly proven by the board, and so there's a request that it be prorated, be prorated by two-thirds and one-third.
We recognize that this court, I filed the objection, but we recognize that what this court's policy is that they impose all of the costs. I remember in the Prelosnick case, where the court imposed full costs, even to include bringing in a witness for the board from Las Vegas whose testimony was worthless and in particular count was dismissed. That was, as I recall, a couple thousand out of the ten. I sincerely request this court to take a look at this, because the way this cost is administered is it encourages the board to expand its charges beyond that what can be proved, and it ought to be the board should be forced to focus its charges, and that would be good for the system. So that's why we made the objection.
Well, maybe that's not ready for the court, since there'll be if you should not prevail, there will be additional costs for appeal.
Well, that certainly is true, and in the cost of appeal, I doubt that there would be any objections to, because the board didn't cross appeal, and we're not dealing with the merits of the particular portions of the board case that was dismissed.
So you won't have any objection to the appeals?
Well, I doubt it. I'd have to look at the time and everything, but I doubt that that would be an objection.
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You will have time for rebuttal. Mr. Bastings, you represent the Board of Attorneys for Professional Responsibility.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Mr. Hildebrand. My name is Thomas J. Bastings, Sr. of Brennan Style, Basting and McDougall of Janesville, and I do represent the complainant respondent Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility. Although the record in this case is lengthy and the issues are alleged to be complicated and the referee's two reports total 106 pages, I don't think there are as many factual disputes as the respondent contends in this case. In disciplinary cases, I think it's important to point out that this court reviews the findings of the referees and adopts them unless and only unless they are clearly erroneous. Here it's the board's contention that the referee's findings on the 8 counts that she found for violations are not clearly erroneous. Likewise, in disciplinary cases, this court has stated many, many times that the referee is the finder of fact and is the ultimate judge of the credibility of witnesses. This case is mostly about credibility, or better yet, the lack of credibility of most of respondents' witnesses, including the respondent herself. As the referee found, this case is basically about a lawyer who took advantage of an infirm elderly client. This case is about a lawyer who, in March of 1993, had this elderly, infirm client execute a power of attorney, which virtually over a 5-month period gave to the respondent complete control of that client's assets. And it's important to keep in mind when we're talking about paying legal fees here that this was not a situation where Mr. Geller sat down, looked at a bill, and wrote a check. This is a case where the respondent wrote checks to herself out of her client's accounts to pay her legal fees of $112,000 over a period of approximately 5 months of representation. When she first came into contact with Mr. Geller, he was in a nursing home. And she had him, as I indicate, execute this power of attorney. And as the referee pointed out, the representation was limited. There was a written fee agreement where she told Mr. Geller, here's what I'm being retained to do. There was no mention of this blended rate that Mr. Scheidman talked about, and there was no mention of case management services in this initial retainer agreement. And there was no mention of personal services for a lawyer to perform, such as going grocery shopping or shopping at the department store for her client. It's also important to remember that Mr. Geller, although he has been portrayed in this case by respondent as somewhat of a sophisticated elderly gentleman who was both manipulative and vindictive, Mr. Geller, as the referee found, suffered from numerous health problems, including congestive heart failure, a long-standing personality disorder. He had never been formally employed in his entire life. Although he was 63 years old at the time, he had lived with his parents in Milwaukee on the west side until their deaths. He was receiving Social Security benefits based upon his mental capacity and his personality disorder. And the respondent knew this. She represented him from March 3rd of 93 until August 14th. During that period of time, it's important to remember that he was hospitalized 3 times. In April for 7 days for congestive heart failure. In June for 10 days for confusion and paranoia. And in July for 6 days for fainting spells. In July, it was right after he was hospitalized, right after the videotape was taken of him allegedly signing this complicated case management agreement. During that period of time, as I indicated, she charged her client $112,000, which she paid to herself. Time isn't going to permit either Mr. Hildebrandt or me this morning to discuss all of the 8 counts that the referee found, but it's important for this court, I think, to take into account as you view this record that these 8 counts encompass the conduct of this lawyer over a 5-month period. They really can't be viewed separately. They have to be all viewed together.
Well, counsel, if I understood Mr. Hildebrandt's argument, he's saying, okay, maybe you have excessive fees here, maybe not, but you don't show fraud. And he says, how do you show fraud? And he says you didn't do it. So what are the 8 counts? And what is it, submitting bills to the client that contain misrepresentations and fraudulent misrepresenting her use of the $3,000 cashier check? Is that the second?
It's the cashier's check. All it's right. The fraudulent billing, the and excessive fees.
Then you got videotaping, fraud and videotaping, charging and collecting excessive and reasonable fees, failing to act with reasonable diligence and promptness in handling the checking account,
right.
Failing to keep the client reasonably informed of the status of his financial affairs and explaining them to him reasonably so that he could have an informed decision, and violating trust account rules.
Right. 2 trust account violations, 1 violating the anti-commingling rule where she placed her funds into her trust account, funds that she was paying to herself for fees, and then when a dispute arose, instead of leaving the money in the trust account, took it out. Admittedly a catch-22 situation, but nevertheless strict liability as far as the board is concerned.
All right. And those are the findings of the referee?
Yes,
referee?
Those are the 8 counts of violation that the referee found.
Okay. Mr. Hildebrandt emphasized fraud.
Yes.
Fraudulent, and not some of the others. But so what is your response to his argument that this was not proved?
I think you have to look at what the charge was. It's an 8.4C violation. It's an 8.4C violation which alleges that the respondent engaged in conduct involving dishonesty, deceit, and misrepresentation. And the referee looked at her bills that she submitted to her client and had him, at least on one occasion, she claimed, had him sign while he was in the hospital under very difficult circumstances, that it was, the referee found that those billings were replete with deceit and misrepresentation and did not really reflect the time that the referee felt under the testimony of the expert witnesses that a lawyer would have spent. And that the 2 instances that counsel complains about where the referee found that on one of her timesheets she misrepresented the number of hours, his complaint is that when the case was concluded, he moved, respondent moved for reconsideration, the referee said, I don't believe I'm allowed to reconsider. To me, that's a red herring in this case because there was so many other findings that the referee made regarding her billings that it's really
but
not...
But she had erred in a couple of things, as
yes.
I understand this record. She
yes.
had erred. Okay, well now, if I understood his argument is that Attorney Gilbert said she did such and such in such and such a time, and you were not able to show she never did it, and you were not able to show that she didn't use that time. I mean, I'm restating his argument.
The record is full of instances where we showed that on days where she claimed to have done something, other evidence in the record showed that she was not there or was not available at the time that that could have been done, where she charged 6 hours for and I can't remember the exact instances, of to perform a task. Someone said there's no way it could have taken that long, and the referee basically found that her explanation, she was not credible. And in looking at the records and in looking at the original billings, as the referee found initially in this representation, she submitted two sets of bills to her client. She submitted one set which had a different set of hours than the second set for the same period of time. And her explanation was that some unknown clerical person who she never was able to identify in her office made that mistake, that it was a mistake made by a clerical person, and that it didn't include what she called her out-of-office time, the time it took her to drive from her office to Mr. Geller's apartment. She was charging him $125 an hour for, and she claimed that that first bill didn't include that because the clerical person had made an error. The referee just flat out plain didn't believe her, said, "I don't believe you."
Now, was this her only client? Was this a full-time only client?
Pretty much so, Your Honor. There was testimony in the record that indicated that she was doing very little else of representation during that time, although there was some evidence that the evidence came in the way of showing that she had never, in fact, charged $165 an hour to anybody in her whole life in Wisconsin when she practiced here for any tasks. And the referee points that out in her report.
I'm sorry, I forgot. How did she get this position? How did she get to represent Mr. Geller?
He was referred to her by a lawyer in Milwaukee by the name of Alan Schatz, I believe, who had formerly represented Mr. Geller's father and was representing Mr. Geller, and he didn't feel as though he had the expertise and maybe didn't want to take the time, and so he referred her to Mr. Geller, and she went to see him in the nursing home, and that's what occurred.
Had Mr. Geller gone through any other attorneys?
No.
Well, had he gone?
The record doesn't indicate that.
Had Mr. Schatz been his attorney?
Mr. Schatz had done some work for him, yes, and he testified in this case.
Overall, when you look at it, over 5 months, there's a potential of 1,000 to probably 1,500 billing hours, depending upon how many hours you want to work.
Well, it was never clear how many hours there were. We tried to add them up, and they came up to the $900 to $1,000 area, and the respondent tried to reconstruct this, and there's evidence in the record that she was reconstructing this and feeding information to her expert, Attorney Holmes from Oklahoma, who the referee also found not to be credible because there was so much information that he was never given in order to give his opinion. And she felt that the testimony on the expert, on the unreasonableness of the fees, she adopted the testimony of Attorney Barbara Becker of Milwaukee, a very highly qualified elder law attorney, as opposed to the testimony of Mr. Holmes from Oklahoma, who said he was simply not familiar with Wisconsin procedures and charges in Wisconsin.
I'd like to just, are you done, Chief? I'd like to just ask a quick question on the videotape itself.
Yes.
When she provided that tape, did she make any representations with respect to it?
When she provided the tape initially to the District Grievance Committee, I believe, in Milwaukee, she offered it, as the record shows, as evidence of the competence of her client in signing the case management agreement. The board charged that this tape, and I think it's necessary to understand just exactly how this charge came about and what it was. Again, it's an 8.4C violation. It's engaging in conduct involving dishonesty, deceit, and misrepresentation. And I think it's fortunate that this court, if you so choose, has, because the tape is an exhibit in this case and it's part of the record, has an opportunity to take a look at this tape.
Right, but she had an obligation to provide it.
I agree.
And if she hadn't provided it, she'd been in trouble too.
I, And I don't think it's the providing it that formed the basis for the allegation. It's what the tape was. In other words,
right, but did she? I'm sorry, I interrupted
no.
you. Did Mr. Hildebrand, on page 22 of his brief, says that the complaint alleges Gilbert offered the videotape as evidence of her client's competence? And then he goes on, but there is no evidence to sustain this charge, and that's the basis of my question. What evidence was there? Did she say in writing that this was evidence of the competency, or did she state that orally to somebody?
The tape was offered as part of testimony at the District Grievance Committee, and it's my recollection, Your Honor, that part of the record has the testimony from the District Grievance Committee, as well as Ms. Gilbert's testimony in this hearing, where I believe I asked her questions about presentation of this tape to the board. I mean, clearly she had an obligation to give it to the board. Clearly she fulfilled that obligation. But it's the tape itself, when you view it, and she says, this is evidence of my client's competence, and then her conduct in what she did vis-a-vis this tape. In other words, she received advice from Attorney Schneidman. Attorney Schneidman said, well, it'd be best to videotape this to show that your client is competent. And so she did that. But the tape itself shows that it was chaos when she did this tape. Her children were running around the room. There was a housekeeper sitting on the couch who Ms. Gilbert had hired, who was prompting Mr. Geller to give answers to the questions she was asking him on the tape. There was this loud, large TV playing in the background. And in fact, at one point in the tape, I think she says, Mr. Geller, that's the TV I bought for you. And that's another subject here.
Which home are they in? Her home or Geller's home?
Geller's home.
Okay.
And it shows Mr. Geller sitting at a desk trying to write on this document without taking the cap off of his pen. He has to be reminded he had to take the cap off the pen to write. Then the camera, she's running the camera, and she zooms in and says, now, okay, I've explained this very complicated agreement to you. Now, would you sign it? And it shows that it had already been signed. Signature was already on the document.
If I were going to, by hindsight, represent somebody about whom there was a question of ability to understand, and practiced today with, quote, mod technology, unquote, of cameras, I probably would go have a camera set up and explain fully as I could, and then ask questions. Do you understand? Do you understand? Do you understand? And then are you willing to sign and have it all on the record? Sort of like police departments now do, or some do with the Miranda warnings and a confession.
Yes.
So it's proof that there was no undue coercion and there was full and competent understanding. Okay. Is that what this tape was supposed to do? I mean, is that what Schneidman was saying to her to do? I mean, that's pretty good advice.
Well, no one ever questioned the advice of Mr. Schneidman in this case. He did testify as an expert, and he did, but it was important. He looked at the videotape afterwards, and he was asked at the hearing in this case whether he formed an opinion as to whether or not her client was competent, and he said, no, I'm not really qualified to do that, and I'm not going to give an opinion in that regard.
Well, but did he...
But she did follow his advice.
Well, was his advice to reenact the signing, or was
no.
his advice to, when she does something like this, to have it taped so that others can verify?
His advice was simply that it would be a good idea perhaps to have the signing of the agreement videotaped.
And now, did she purport to have this as the signing of the agreement? I mean, did she present it to the board or to the district committee? I think that was the point of Justice Babbage's question. Did she submit this as the enactment of the signing, and therefore he was confident?
I believe, I'm not too sure she was ever asked the question of whether she submitted this to directly show that it was to portray the signing. I think you have to draw that inference from the
record. Counsel, page 13 of your brief.
Yes.
You state that Gilbert testified she went to Armin Geller's home on July 20th, 1993 to have him sign the case management agreement. That's a reference to the record. That she took a video camera with her for purposes of visually recording the signing of the agreement. Reference to the record. She further testified that during the videotaping of this event, her client was fully confident, very aware of his surroundings, and that he signed the agreement with full knowledge of what it meant. Reference to the record.
Yes.
And that seems to be the response.
Yes. The issue, I think the probably the key issue in this entire disciplinary proceeding is the unreasonableness of the fee. The referee found that the respondent charged a fee which was excessive and unreasonable, and recommended that the respondent be ordered to make restitution of $84,800 to her client plus interest at the legal rate as a condition of her reinstatement. It's important to note that the referee based those findings both as to the unreasonableness of the fee and the amount of restitution on the credibility of the witnesses that testified in this case. The board offered the testimony, as I indicated, of a very highly qualified elder law attorney, Barbara Becker of Milwaukee, on both issues. She testified both on the issue of unreasonableness and the issue of restitution. And we took a page from a recommendation that was made by a member of this court on the issue of restitution in a prior case, and we had a separate hearing on restitution. In other words, what we did here is the referee, we tried the case in chief, the referee made her findings, made her recommendation for discipline, the 3-year suspension, and then she held a hearing separately on the issue of restitution. We did that because we believe it's a procedure that this court needs in order to have a good, solid record on the issue of restitution, rather than this court in the past having to look at some of these cases and take a guess sometimes on restitution because the record simply is not sufficient. Attorney Becker testified that the respondent's fees were excessive and unreasonable. She used the words grossly excessive. That's how she put it. She also testified that, in her opinion, the respondent's scheme to qualify her client for a community options program would not have worked. That scheme gets somewhat complicated, but basically what she was doing was taking all of Mr. Geller's assets, putting them into her name or into a joint account with Mr. Geller, and then executing this case management agreement where Geller was saying, now you have all my money, you will take that money and you will pay yourself attorney's fees for representing me on into the future, and you will use whatever else is there to pay for my care, and it's out of my control, it's a legal divestiture, and therefore I qualify for the community options program. Attorney Becker said, sorry, it's not going to work. And the referee said that was the only competent expert testimony in this case. She adopted Ms. Becker's findings that, in fact, that scheme was not going to work. And under those circumstances, it's our position that because those findings were made based upon the only credible elder law attorney expert testimony in this case, that this court should not disturb them. Respondent has attempted to counter that testimony with a testimony with an elder law attorney from Oklahoma, as I indicated before, who had not read Geller's deposition, who had not reviewed the videotape, and in fact, he testified that he was relying basically on a self-serving analysis of hours worked prepared by the respondent. He testified that he was under the impression from the respondent that Mr. Geller was a demanding, manipulative client, and the referee said his testimony was not credible and adopted the testimony of Ms. Becker. At the restitution hearing, the respondent offered the testimony of a case manager and a CPA. It's important also to keep in mind here that the respondent is also a CPA. And the respondent attempted to show at the restitution hearing that she performed other services for which she should be compensated. The referee found that their testimony was based on an improper foundation and was therefore not credible and adopted the testimony of Attorney Becker, who did a three-point analysis. She used three different methods of arriving at her analysis as to what a reasonable fee would have been in this case. The board asserted to the referee that a reasonable fee to accomplish what Mr. Geller wanted accomplished would have been approximately $7,500. The referee gave the respondent the benefit of the doubt from Attorney Becker's testimony and found that some of the case management services that she may have performed were worth more, and found that a reasonable fee would have been $27,200, and then ordered restitution for the balance. Those findings were based upon the referee's careful analysis of the credible testimony, and we believe that under those circumstances, those findings should not be disturbed. Respondent does make much of the fact that she called highly respected attorney Dan Schneidman as an expert in this case, and his testimony is most important for what he did not say, not for what he said. Mr. Schneidman did not offer testimony on the reasonableness of the fee because he admitted that he would defer to an elder law attorney for that analysis. He did not offer an opinion on whether Armin Geller was competent during the videotaping. He did say that a blended fee was appropriate. In other words, the basis of Mr. Schneidman's testimony was that it's okay for a lawyer, with the consent of the client, to say, I'm going to perform some non-legal services for you, and I'm going to charge you a blended fee, which is something of an average between my highest or regular hourly rate and a lower rate for these other services. But that's basically what Mr. Schneidman's testimony was. We talked briefly about the big screen TV. I don't want to go into that in any detail because I have very little time left, but the referee found that she engaged in deceitful misconduct for a number of reasons. Because of what she told Attorney Ruth Irvings, who was Mr. Geller's new attorney, when Ms. Irvings said, there's a money order here for $3,000 to American TV. What's that for? And she told Ms. Irvings, I bought a TV for Mr. Geller. And Ms. Irvings said, well, who signed for it? And she said, well, Geller did. It turns out later when she testified at the grievance committee and then at the hearing that actually what happened, this was a convoluted story about how she was going to buy a TV, but then she discovered that it was only the remote that wasn't working, so instead of, she had this money order, she couldn't cash it back in because it was made to American TV, so she went to American TV and bought a $3,000 TV for herself and gave her client a credit against the fees that she was paying herself. That's what the big screen TV was about, and the board's assertion is that she deceived Ms. Irvings, she deceived the grievance committee, she wouldn't really ever talk about what that was until she was finally pressed at a hearing and she said, come on, what happened? And she said, well, I bought the TV for myself. And that conduct, leading up to the time when she finally said that's what she did, was deceitful, dishonest, and misrepresentation.
Can I, before you conclude, I'm still hung up on this videotape. If I videotape something at my, as an attorney, and I'm reenacting a signing because I think that videotaping that signing is going to show that my client is competent, and I get what I get, right? And maybe everything explodes in my face, as apparently it did to her. It's one thing to say that I did this for the purpose of showing competency, because that could be in completely good faith. You know, it blows up in your face, but you did it. It's quite another thing to say, I am giving this to you, District Grievance Committee, as proof of the competency of my client. Now, what occurred? What was the? What's the fact here? Did she give that to the district committee and say, this is proof of the competency, or did she give it to them and say, I took this to show the competency of my client, and then made no comment as to what the tape actually showed?
It's my recollection, and this is only recollection because I don't think we addressed this in the brief, Your Honor, is that at the grievance committee she presented the tape to show that her client had. Show him signing the agreement. It was our contention that when she took the tape, she knew the agreement had already been signed by him, and that was a charade, and to show his competence in entering into this case management agreement.
Is there anything wrong with reenacting a signing?
I think there's nothing wrong with reenacting the signing unless you are attempting to tell someone that it's not a reenactment.
And that's your position, and that was the position
yes.
that you took. That.
Yes.
But she saw this tape, I presume. I'm just having a hard time believing that having looked at the videotape, and we will look at this tape, having looked, and presumably she looked at the tape, and she was there videotaping it. I mean, she had to know what that tape showed.
I'm sure she did.
And wouldn't she think she was kidding if, in fact, these are the facts?
I don't know. I can't look into her mind.
Well, this is covered by the referee, if I'm reading the right thing, in the appendix. Count 4. The board is proven by clear and satisfactory. I'm on page 27. Board is proven by clear and satisfactory evidence that the respondent's offer of a videotape purporting to show our client's execution of the case management agreement was a violation of 20:8.4C. She was engaged in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. Gilbert attempted to conceal the fact that Geller had already signed several copies of the document. And then at the end, on page 31-32, the referee says that the respondent continued to record this charade as unconscionable, that she would rely on the videotape to show that her client understood the many complex provisions of the document, that is, dementia, blah, blah, is in reckless disregard of her responsibility to the client. Based on the evidence, referee finds that respondent violated SCR 8.4C by offering the videotape to show her client signing the agreement when it had already been signed. That was the fight.
That's the thrust of what I just said, yes.
Okay.
If I can conclude the red light.
Very briefly.
So, this court has continually warned lawyers that if you bilk your clients, if you overbill them, if you engage in deceitful conduct, you will be severely disciplined. This court should now say that if you prey upon the elderly and the infirm and the disabled, you will lose your license to practice law. The Armand Gellers of the state need this court's protection from lawyers who act as the respondent did here. The referee considered each and every mitigating factor claimed by the respondent regarding discipline, and instead of recommending revocation, as was urged by the board, recommended only a 3-year suspension and restitution, and this court should do no less. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Basting. Mr. Hildebrand?
I'd like to correct 3 things very briefly. First of all, there is no evidence in this record that shows why the tape was offered to the grievance committee. The excerpt on page 13 of the brief that Your Honor referred to comes from the trial. At the trial, she said she felt that it was evidence of his competency, but she did. There's no evidence as to what she said to the grievance committee, and that's the basis of the charge.
The basis of the charge is offering it to the grievance committee.
That's correct, Your Honor. The second, my opponent, I believe, mistakenly said that it came out at the hearing that the $3,000 credit was given and all of that. The board examiner who testified at the hearing admitted that by the end of the grievance committee investigation, they knew that the $3,000 was used for a TV set, and that Gilbert had bought the TV set. They also knew that a credit had been given. This was at the end of the investigation before it was charged. We've cited that in our brief, so I would like to correct that mistake. Finally, there's another thing, is that the referee did not determine that the so-called top plan would not work. She said in her opinion that because Ruth Irving's terminated his participation, nobody knows whether it would work or not. She said that Holmes's opinion, he was not a Wisconsin lawyer, did not count for Cox. She did not find him incredible on other issues. My opponent did not mention the testimony of Rassman, the person who administers the COP program for Milwaukee County. And he testified that it would have worked, and if it didn't work, it could have been corrected before the October 1 deadline. So I would like to rebut that. Now I would like to spend some time talking about Barbara Becker's opinion. First of all, she opined that the attorney's fees were unreasonable, but she didn't consider most of the services that were rendered. She said, I'm not an expert in case management. I don't know about this financial stuff. I don't even have an opinion on whether so-called paralegal time could be charged. To show the falsity of her opinion, she went through the statements and said that there were 131 hours of undisputed legal services valued at $16,400, and then because of her first opinion that it wasn't worth it, she discounted it to $7,000. And the referee purportedly followed this second approach. So we don't have an opinion about the unreasonableness of fees from Attorney Becker. Now let's go to the restitution hearing. Can you imagine imposing restitution based on the opinion of an attorney who did not even review the fee statements? She did not review the fee statements to support her opinion as to what restitution should be. That is one of the most outrageous things that happened in this case. And then our experts were disregarded because the referee was convinced that there were errors in Jill Gilbert's statements. Our expert showed that based on some 400 hours of case management services, Gilbert saved Geller a ton of money, a lot of money. This is not fair, and it isn't right. These opinions do not support the conclusions of the referee in either respect. Now I would like to talk about the
Before you do that, counsel, you had referred to the time records, and just for a little assistance, in your brief, rather appendix, on page 115.
Yes,
and that's
I was just about to get it.